So welcome to the show, Jack.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Nicole.
It's great to have you here. And many of my listeners totally know who you are because I talk about you all the time on the podcast. But there are a few who may have never taken that extra step and gone and checked out your podcast. So tell us, who is Jack Spearco and how did you get where you are today?
So if you ask people who Jack Spearco is, you get a variety of answers. One is he's a professional jerk. So I've made a living out of being a jerk in some ways, but I don't mean it in the typical way. I mean it in kind of a funny tongue-in-cheek way. But somebody in my audience once said it stands for just encouraging real knowledge. And then some people, like, they get kind of mad when you give them the truth. So I'm kind of a professional educator and entertainer today with a podcast much like yours that's been running for 11 years. And has somewhere just south of 250,000 daily downloads. So that's where I am today. But where I started out was very much a typical American non-success story. I grew up in my childhood split between the swamplands of North Florida, which is really like southern Georgia in a lot of ways back in the 70s. And about my time when I went into high school, we moved to rural Pennsylvania, where my family's originally from, grew up in the mountains there. So my dad was an entrepreneur, a relatively successful one, but so cheap he could make a penny scream. So we always lived like we were poor, even though he did okay. I ended up growing up the second part of my life in my grandparents' home that was built in the 1880s. And today, the house somehow is still standing. It's probably worth, you know, $30,000 if my dad were to sell it. So I kind of grew up in a poverty consciousness and knew I needed to get out of rural Pennsylvania if I wanted to make anything out of my life. And I was very ambitious. I didn't know for what. I just had ambition. So I joined the Army because they said they'd let me jump out of planes and shoot really big guns. And, you know, when you're 17 and everything sucks around you, they're like, we'll give you money for college. You can shoot at people and you can jump out of planes. That sounds better than, you know, lying in a ditch here doing meth and getting a job at an auto body shop. So, yeah, I'll do that. And so I left and I did that for 3 years and realized the Army life wasn't for me. And there were certain things about home I like fishing and hunting and some of the people I knew. So I tried to go home again, and I learned real quick that you can't go home again. It's real. When I went back there, as bad as it was worse. Like, everything that sucked, like, sucked 100 times more. There was no sense of mission or purpose like I had in the military. And then I realized, like, part of it was me. I would go to the grocery store and be pissed off that people didn't know how to stand in line right and what have you. And I was talking to one of my Army buddies who had been in a lot longer than me and had almost, like, had just actually retired. So he was a guy that was a first sergeant to me. He said, Jack, the problem isn't them, it's you. You're still militarized. You have to decouple. And I had served nothing but overseas during my entire service other than my basic training in AIT. So I had not only been in the military, I had been around nothing but military for 3 years. So I decided I need to get this crap out of me. So I took a walk on the Appalachian Trail. I walked from Pennsylvania to northern New Hampshire, got out of my system, came down to Texas where I live still today, started out my career as a guy that packed boxes for $6 an hour. Hated that, decided I wanted something more in my life. Somehow convinced some company to be stupid enough within 5 years to give me a sales job in telecommunications, which I had moved into as a technician. And so by the time I was like 25, 26 years old, I was knocking back 100 grand a year, which was pretty good for some stupid kid from the coal region that never darkened the door of a college. And from there, I went into higher level sales. By my mid-30s, I was sick, fat, angry, pissed off at the world, but making a lot of money. And that's kind of hard to explain to a wife who dealt with all those years of fighting and struggle to get there. I don't want to do this anymore. I decided I wanted to learn more about marketing. I took a marketing job, and I went from making about $200,000 a year to making $45,000. That was difficult.
Yeah.
But it put me around people that did nothing but marketing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like, we had like a think tank of just younger than me mostly marketers, and that's why I took the job. I wanted to be surrounded by people that knew what I wanted to get better at. I had actually gotten really good at it. In a lot of ways, I was better than a lot of the people that were there, but a lot of little things that they were doing were things that, you know, the young has time to screw with and the old don't. Mm-hmm. And so within a year of that, I was back up to knocking back really good money. Took a very short stint for a telecom company as the director of marketing. That company got bought out. Met up with a guy named Neil Franklin, who was a client. He became a business partner. We worked together about 6 years. Built like 5-6 different companies up, sold some of them off, ran some of them, and even with that, I was just still miserable. So I got my car, started doing a podcast on a MP3 recorder about 3 years ago. 18 months into that, I was making enough money to quit my job, and I have done nothing but podcast, educate, and entertain ever since. So that's a long story, but trust me, there's a lot left out of it.
Well, it may be a long story, but it's by sharing your stories, you've gone through that journey. You're inspiring a bunch of other people to do, not necessarily become podcasters, but to do something similar in their life, because your repeated theme is you were miserable with what you were doing, and now you're not, right?
Exactly. I love what I do. I would say, like, I had one person ask me one time, like, what's the biggest difference between you and your haters? Because, like, if you get successful, and you're probably getting there at this point, where you have to rejoice when you start getting haters, right? Because, like, that means you're making a difference. The biggest difference between me and my haters, and I think this is why you have haters when you become successful doing things your own way, is if tomorrow, like, I don't play the lottery, but let's say somebody bought me a lottery ticket and mailed it to me for a present. And all of a sudden, holy shit, I just won $20 million. The next day, I would probably take a trip to Tahiti or something. But within a couple of weeks of taking a vacation, relaxing, seeing a tax attorney, getting my money squared away, I'd be like, hi, folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. I would keep doing what I'm doing. I might go to a 4-day work week instead of a 5-day work week or something, but I would keep doing what I'm doing for the rest of my life. The people that hate on me, if they won the lottery, they would never live the life they're living again until they spent all their money and got broke and had to. And that's what I try to inspire people to do, to create a lifestyle where if somebody handed you $10 million, you'd be happy about it, but you wouldn't change that much. Maybe you'd have a bigger piece of land. Maybe you'd have a nicer house. But in the end, whatever you're doing is basically what you would be doing. As a podcaster, it may be the worst business model ever because you turn people into solo entrepreneurs and then they don't have time to listen to your podcast anymore. That's the number one way I lose listeners. I either piss them off or I turn them into like hardworking entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Although you do have time as a hardworking entrepreneur if you have the right kind of job to still listen to TSP. But I'm behind like 3 or 4 weeks right now.
Yeah.
That's typical.
See?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just asked somebody if they're going to your workshop, and he was like, well, if there are still seats available, I'm like, oh, no, that ship sailed a while ago.
That was an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and that was only because we added seats because I kept getting people that were carpooling and Ubering, because that's limited by how many cars can park here, as you know. And there's also a limit to, like, if I go to Dorothy and say, we sold 55 seats, I'm going to get punched in the face.
For you don't want to get punched in the face by Dorothy.
My wife, and I taught her how to throw good punches, so yeah, I don't want that. Like, there's a cap. But yeah, we sold out really quick. I think it's because of what we do. Like, you come here all the time, you know, it's something special, man. It's wild.
Well, and I think that is because you've created the life you want to live, and you want to share that with people and empower them to do that and empower them to empower others to do that. So when you get those quality of people all together in one place, awesome things happen.
Yeah, it is.
You don't even need to go in there with an agenda like, you know, in the old days when you were supposed to be networking and it was like, I have to meet 3 people and get 2 business cards and, you know, you remember those rules?
Yeah.
You don't need to do that there. You're going to come across somebody at your workshop that's got some insight or that you end up pairing up with, and both of you do better because of it.
Yeah.
That happened to me at your first one.
Yeah. You're talking about the days of going like Chamber of Commerce meetings. You walk over to a table, there's 5 dudes there. You say hello and they're all real estate agents.
Yeah.
And then you're like, the hell with this. You kick the table and like 27 financial advisors come out from underneath it. I don't miss that at all. Yeah. When we do it here, like the only thing we had to do to really encourage that, and it was something that you and our buddy David really kind of, I was already doing it, but you guys like encouraged it to be something bigger, was get people to really introduce themselves.
Yeah.
Like that's all we really had to do to like turn that, like supercharge that dynamic, was get people to stand up and say, I'm so-and-so, I'm from this place, and this is what I'm, because I had them doing that, but it was like, this is what I'm looking for in my life.
Right.
Once we started doing that, it was like, holy shit, look at all these puzzle pieces that just go together if you get out of the way and don't touch it. You know, it's like a self-assembling puzzle. We've got people in businesses that met here 4 or 5 years ago now that are working still in long-term partnerships and businesses today. That's like, I had a pretty big vision for this, but that probably was not part of it in the beginning.
And that's where it's ended up going. And it's funny because that's kind of how freedom works, right?
Absolutely.
It's the way freedom's supposed to work. So speaking of that, what does freedom mean to you? And when you're seeking your own path, how does that play into it?
Well, I think that the big problem for most Americans is they don't actually have a good answer to the first question you ask. What does freedom mean to you? Because most Americans, most people in the modern world, most people in the world, believe that freedom is living a certain way. And that means that you can do whatever you want as long as you do it the way that I say you should. So it's and it's amazing, like even outside of the law, the little things people get upset about. Like I'm, as you know, I'm on a keto diet at this point. I've lost almost 30 pounds in 50 days.
I'm just not ready to do that yet.
Well, you don't have to, right? See, and that's freedom. Like I'm telling you that works. You're not ready. Okay. Right. That's freedom. But what's not freedom is when people get, we talk about haters. I have people pissed off at me for saying I'm doing a keto diet losing weight. and that might not sound like it really has anything to do with politics, but it has everything to do with politics. Like, I'm not bothering you. I didn't tell you you had to do this too. I'm doing my thing over here. Some people are doing it too. Everybody's happy. Nobody's holding a gun to anybody's head, either directly or by proxy, and everything's fine. To me, that's freedom in all walks of life. So the scary thing about freedom for people is if you want the ability to live your life on your own terms, then you have to give other people the same level of liberty. And that means until such time as your neighbor sets your house on fire, you don't have anything to say. If he burns his own house down safely, as long as it's done safely, it's not your business. Or if he's living there with his husband, right, and they're two dudes living together and they want to say they're married, that's not your business. It's not something I really want to be a big part of, but it's not my business. If the guy down the street likes to medicate himself with cannabis, that's his business. If he's not blowing smoke in your face, it's not your business. And so to me, freedom means the ability to pursue your dreams however you see fit until such time as you harm another. And that no one should be able to use force or coercion against anybody in any instance except self-defense or defense of another innocent party. Which means, of course, I don't want a state. I don't want a government. And people think that's fanciful. It's a big, scary word. Anarchy. I prefer the word voluntarist. People think that's crazy. And like my entire point is I simply feel that all actions between all people should be voluntary. I don't know. That doesn't sound crazy to me. Any objection to that sounds a little bit psychotic to me. Like, so what you're saying is not all actions should be voluntary. You're saying that you should be able to force me to do something I don't want to do, even if I'm not harming you. And most people say, no, I'm not saying that. No, what you're saying is since you don't have the ability or the fortitude or the courage to do it yourself, you want to stick your hand up in something we called an election. You want to vote. And you want somebody with guns to do it for you by proxy. So to me, liberty is as little of that as we can have. And I am not one of these purist, I call them purist asshole anarchists, where like everybody that doesn't agree with me is an idiot. Like that's just, I wasn't born an anarchist. You weren't born an anarchist. That's just assholism. There's people that become anarchist bookworms. They read like everything every anarchist ever wrote, and it just tunnel vision. And I'm not saying reading's bad or reading that works bad, like, but when they only read that, they become tunnel vision to it. Every cop is an abusive bastard that beats his wife, you know, and plants evidence. No, that's not how it works, you know. And so when we stay more broad with that, we understand, like, if somebody said to me, I joke sometimes that if you gave me a button to dissolve government, I'd push it, like, but if you do that, push. I really wouldn't. I would prefer a switch.
Yeah.
It's like a dimmer switch.
A dimmer switch, yep.
Because we have, like, if you take a person dependent on heroin and you just take away their heroin with no medical treatment, they can die. So imagine that times, I don't know, what is it, 9 billion people in the world today? Right, or even 300 million in the United States. Like, you can't just flip that switch. But we need to begin turning that down. And if when people say my roads, I need, who would build the roads? If I had a government that sought a national defense and built roads and left everything else alone, I'd still be thinking, how can we get rid of that? But I'd be pretty happy. Mm-hmm. Right? I'd be pretty happy. And as an anarchist, I kind of feel this way. Minarchy's great, so that's just for the people that are not initiate, that's a very small government. That's a very small government.
Very small.
Unless a significant number of people are trying to find a way to eliminate a monarchy, it becomes an oligarchy.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happened in the United States. The United States was a monarchy, especially under the initial Articles of Confederation.
Right.
We had this huge blight that I think really screwed things up called slavery.
It was a problem.
But that, yep. I think that really accelerated the movement from monarchy into oligarchy, but it still would have happened anyway. The only way to maintain a monarchy is to have about half of the population trying to figure out how to get rid of it altogether. Even if they never succeed, even if it never gets any smaller, it's the cap. It's the cap. And one of the things I try to get across with people with liberty today is a lot of things we think we need. If we didn't have them, would you want them today? Right? I mean, one of the things, like, there's a group here moving for Texas, which is Texas leaving the Union and becoming its own nation. And I don't know whether that'll happen or not, but their most interesting question was, if Texas was a nation of its own today, and you lived here, and you looked at the United States with all its problems, and there was a measure not to remove yourself from the Union, but to join it, would you? And so to me, liberty, that's the question people need to start asking. All these things that we think we can't do without, if they didn't exist today, and your life was pretty much the way it is or better, would you want it at the expense and the cost and the threat to liberty that it is? And I think most people would say no. Generally, we make these plunges into to taking liberty under fear. Look what happened since 9/11. And no matter what you think happened about 9/11, you can't deny that our freedom and liberty has just gone downhill into a shit can since 9/11. They changed the definition of financial relationship to be able to look in your safe deposit box because of 9/11. The last time I checked, Muhammad Atta did not keep his razor knife in a safe deposit box.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, like, stuff like that. So that's what liberty means to me. The short answer is you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anybody else. And that's why I say when you tell me that this is the freest nation that's ever existed, I think that you are proof that it isn't. Because the way that it is now, only a system of complete and total indoctrination would ever make you say something that stupid. I really believe that.
Well, I find it interesting. We live in a relatively safe society, even the most unsafe parts of our country.
Absolutely.
When compared with other countries around the world. And we think it's because we have this state police system, but I don't think that's true. I think it's because we've agreed not to attack each other, and that's probably because of our relative level of prosperity here. Even our poor people are fairly prosperous.
Well, another thing here is the fact that we do have an armed society. Now, there's actually less people armed than unarmed. There's, by my estimation, about 55 million gun owners in America. There's 300 million people. So we are the minority. But do the math. And if you're a thug and you're going to go break in somebody's house, if you do that for a living and you break in one house a week, there's pretty good math that sooner or later you're going to run into somebody that's home when you thought they weren't, even if you're a cat burglar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, if you keep doing that, sooner or later, with 55 million people armed and willing to shoot you in the face, the odds that you're going to get shot in the face are nearly 100% if you make a career out of this choice. If you live in Somalia, where everybody tells me to go, I don't know why they picked Somalia. There was a guy that went to, like, from Anarchast, he went to Somalia.
Yeah,
totally not an anarchy, by the way. Like, totally a police state. But if you live in Somalia and you manage to scrape up an AK-47... and you go into some hut out in the sticks to steal people's stuff, there's pretty good odds that you can just walk in there, point a gun at people's face and take whatever you want and not get shot in the face. So part of what makes us stable here is that, in general, we're prosperous. And that's more what you're saying than we've agreed not to. People mm-hmm. that are prosperous tend to not take things from other people. Right, so that's one of the reasons I see socialism is so dangerous, because it reduces prosperity.
It does.
And therefore you have more aggression, because
it also teaches you that taking things from somebody else is okay.
It's okay, and since they have more, that's what socialism is. We take from the people who have the most, and we give the people who have the least. Well, I have less than him, so why can't I do it? Like, don't kids turn out a lot like their parents, so they try to be like their parents? Well, we turn the state into a parent. And then we're surprised when a socialist state creates thieves. Gee, that's shocking. But then you add to it I might get shot in the face. You know, or I might get shot in the face and then bit by a bunch of dogs and then shot in the ass and then be, even if I live, crippled for the rest of my life. And then go to jail as a crippled person that got shot in the face, not comfortable. Right? So we have all of those things that keep things relatively stable in the United States. And if you look at all the countries in the world, whether they're socialist, whether they're monarchies, whether they're republics like we are, the most stable countries are prosperous. And the problem with the mentality that wants to drag this country into socialism, and they keep saying shit like, well, look at Sweden, look at Denmark. They don't want Sweden and Denmark. They want Venezuela.
Right.
Because here's the thing that works with Sweden. Yeah, you get so supposed free healthcare. You pay the highest taxes in the world, the most for real estate in the world, whatever. But there is certain – you can't say it doesn't work. I've been to Sweden.
It has
worked. It's pretty nice, okay? It's all right, yeah. But go try to immigrate to Sweden, right? It's like, well, what are you bringing to the table? And if they do let you in, you don't get all the free stuff. You pay all the taxes and you don't get the free stuff for a very long time. What the people that want to drag us into socialism want to do is open the border wide, let everybody in, and give out unlimited social benefits. That's actually worse than Venezuela, and we see how that worked out. So you can have, I don't want one, let's to be clear, but you can have a state that has a big social impact on the lives of people. We already have one, honestly, but a bigger one. You can have a state that has, you know, state-run healthcare or whatever. You can't do that, have a stable state, and have open borders because the numbers don't work. It just doesn't work that way. And then if you add something crazy like UBI on top of that with no incentive to work at all, and you say anybody can have it. So like right now, people will climb a border wall. People will pay a coyote. People will go across the desert to come to this country. They're not doing it because their country is so bad, even though that's been what we're told. They're doing it because ours is so good. Now, add to that, oh, and by the way, when you get here, you get free money. And you get free healthcare, and you get free food. And every time you have a kid, we give you more free food. How long is that sustainable? It's not. And that's not, like, you want open borders? Me too. Get rid of all the welfare, we can have all the open borders you want. Because I think people should be able to go where they want to. And then this whole argument that, well, it's the hardest working, most dedicated people that want a better life that come here, would actually be true. And even if it is already true, then the more important thing is politics is the art of the possible. Then the people that oppose it would believe you.
So as you've come in along your journey towards being more freedom-minded, you were conservative first, right?
I was a dyed-in-the-wool, small government conservative when I believed that such things were possible.
And what parts of government did you think were necessary?
I would have given you the classic roads argument, honestly, as stupid as I think that is now. Who's going to build the roads? I thought roads, schools, before I realized the indoctrination centers that schools were and how much better off we'd be without them. But I also thought we needed, you know, a state to at least see to basic law enforcement. Right? I always saw the cop that just wrote tickets as a road pirate before I even knew the term. Like, when somebody said road pirate, I'm like, oh, that's what they are. But, like, I grew up in a small town. Actually, I grew up in a thing called a township, which is like a piece of a county that doesn't have anything else.
Right.
With one cop. His name was Jack Harley. I knew him on a first-name basis. If this guy wanted to arrest me as a teenager, I did some dumb shit. He could have arrested me at least half a dozen times. This guy caught me with beer, just took it away, probably went and drank it somewhere. And when something went wrong, he showed up and he tried to fix the problem. And his goal was, I don't want to arrest anybody unless I have to.
Right.
Today, that same township has less people in it, but now that same township that had one cop has five.
Oh, dear.
Now, you got to really let that sink in. So I grew up with a view of law enforcement that is totally divorced from what we have for law enforcement today. I never saw a cop, you know, geared up like a soldier like I was. Like, when I went off to be a soldier, and I learned what it was to be a soldier, and I came home, cops still didn't look like soldiers. 10 years later, I'm like, what the hell is going on? I said a different word. What is going on? Right? This is bad. And so I thought we needed that level of basic law enforcement. And when I look back to that time and what law enforcement did during that period of time, I'm like, well, it actually worked. So even if we could go back to that level I would be happy. I thought we needed those things. I also thought we needed a smaller government, and I am a natural rebel. So everybody thinks because, you know, I was a small government conservative starting out, that I must come from a family of small government conservatives. I was the only person in my family that wasn't a Democrat. To this day, I am the only person in my family on both sides that's not a Democrat. They're all Democrats. I am called Jack, even though I was born John, because so was my dad, because my grandparents thought John F. Kennedy was God, and everybody called him Jack. Right? I mean, that's
how now we know why.
Right? That's why I'm called Jack today, because I was named John, because we named everybody after a Bible name. And then I was called Jack as John because JFK. And so I just looked at this and went, wait a minute, my whole family lives in poverty, expressing these ideals. Mm-hmm. And none of it works because, and by the time I was old enough to figure it out, the Democrats had controlled the Congress for decades at that point. People forget that today because we've had this swing back and forth. The Democrats controlled the Senate and the House mostly for about 30 years. Even when we had Republican presidents. And right. I was like, well, then none of this works. Look at the shithouse we live in. Like, how is this helping us? So I started investigating other alternatives, and I was actually never a conservative. I thought I was a conservative. I was a small government libertarian. So much so that when I first heard the message of the Libertarian Party, it was like sweet music. I ran for office as a libertarian. While I didn't win, I came in with 16% of the vote for the Texas House in a district where the Republican had never gotten less than 90% of the vote. And I really believed in like that kind of the Libertarian Party was going to save the world. And then eventually I just kind of realized that we're playing their game. And
yeah,
playing their game doesn't work either. So that led me to going, I'm not an big L libertarian. I'm a small L libertarian. And then I was surrounded by conservatives that kept trying to convince me they were too.
Yes.
No, you're not. Well, no, you're not. Well, yeah. Okay, yeah. No, you're not. Right? Because Republicans have never given us a smaller government ever. Ever, period. Show me one that did. Well, you know, they tried. Okay. Yeah. So that led me eventually to become an anarchist. So there's a saying that going from libertarian to anarchist is a 6-month journey. and I think it can be if you don't run into constant purist assholes like we were talking about earlier that think they're helping,
gosh.
But they're not. The people that, you know, every cop is a scumbag. If you're not an anarchist, you're stupid. The Larkin Rose types. For all the good Larkin Rose does, I'm back to a famous line from Friends. Chandler Bing said, you think you're helping, but you're not. And so it took me about 2 years to cross that bridge. One, because I'm a logical thinker, and my question was, then how would we? And instead of giving me answers, what I was told is shut up.
Right.
Okay, well, that's not an answer. Or
that means
stupid.
You don't have an answer.
Or you're stupid.
Don't have an
well, no, if I'm stupid because I'm asking a question, then how stupid are you that you don't have an answer?
Yeah.
Well, we'll figure it out. No, that's not an answer. And eventually I realized my final flip all the way to anarchism was it doesn't matter how. It matters that the choice to steal from another person against their will, to take from another person against their will, or to interfere with the lifestyle of another person against their will by the use of force, whether I do it directly or I pay someone to do it or I vote for somebody to do it, is immoral. It's wrong. It's simply not acceptable. And since that's the case, then my moral choice became anarchy. And the how is, well, since I only want to turn the dimmer switch, why don't we get as close as we can to what I'm looking for before you tell me what we can't do? Because 90% of the crap that we have to control people today didn't even exist only 30 years ago. So 30 years ago, I was, 17? The world was a pretty safe place.
Yeah.
The world was pretty good.
It was.
We did not descend into what people call anarchy. So can't we at least get back to 1985?
You know, it's funny. I've watched somebody I watched their journey from liberty to anarchy. They moved to New Hampshire, came across a bunch of those asshole anarchists, and also has been facing like poverty because getting jobs for her has been hard.
Yeah.
And I'm watching her become socialist now. So yeah. The interesting thing is when a voluntarist or an anarchist becomes a very bureaucratic, rule-pushing person,
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I don't know why they do that, but they do. You start pushing those people who came there away, and guess which way they go? And guess what? They vote.
You want me to explain
it? And we have a system.
Without even a sentence, just a phrase?
Yeah.
A three-word phrase? Extremes create extremes.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the, when people go, how does this happen? Okay, so you are an extremist, and then since your extreme methodology doesn't work, you put north and south poles of the magnet together, and you're going to push as far away as that magnetic field goes. Like any kid did this experiment in school, you take the two magnets, and you push one magnet toward the other, and the other magnet moves away. As far as that thing can push, that's how far that other magnet goes. So the more extreme you get, the stronger the field you put out. And I don't mean this metaphysically. This is an analogy. The more extreme you become in a position, the more extreme you get. Why do you think the Democrats and Republicans both look like, I mean, they've always looked pretty foolish, but they look like, they both look like complete morons today.
I know. Oh, my gosh.
We could argue about who's dumber, but does it really matter if the people running our country are all stupid? And it doesn't matter who went extreme first, because that's what I can hear conservatives listening to your show right now. But they did it first! And then I can hear the Democrats going, no, they didn't win! Well, it doesn't matter who went extreme first. Once one side went extreme, the other side went extreme. And so we live in a society today. Another metaphor is, if you've ever been to like an audio, like a rock concert or something like that, and the audio guy's setting shit up, and while he's setting things up, he drags the microphone too close to one of the receivers or something, and you get that feedback. That's all that exists today in America. No matter what, and so all you get is feedback and screeching, like autistic level monkey screeching from both sides. And when anybody says, hey, wait a minute, can't we find a solution to this that would work for both people? Then both sides turn into full-on monkey crazy and start throwing shit at you. And the left calls you, a Republican right-wing Nazi. At the same time, the right calls you a libtard idiot. Socialist, right? And you're like, I don't agree with either one of you. And so I have to be the other side because extremes create extremes. And that's where we are at a point now. No one can propose anything that isn't 100% in lockstep with what either side wants without being labeled one of them. It's an us and them mentality, and it is very dangerous. And I would love to tell you that I think, well, eventually we'll come to our senses. I think we might. But I think really bad shit's going to happen first.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we're going to, Trump's presidency hasn't been as terrible as everybody said it was going to be.
And that actually enrages the left.
I know.
Like, they're enraged by that.
I know. And so, when we get the next Democrat in, we're going to have somebody even crazier packaged, I think, than Trump.
Do you see what's going on right now with the craziness of the left and the extreme socialism? I don't think the Democratic Party expects, unless we do, like there's some weak economic numbers and all now, if we have some kind of crippling recession, I don't think they expect the White House. I don't think they expect at all. I don't think they expect to retain the House. I think they know that everything they're doing right now is hurting them more. And for those of you that are like, yay, hold on, because the other shoe's fixing to wind up and kick you in the ass. I think what they're doing is they're sending out their complete crazies. Because it's amazing to me, if you could suffer through a few minutes of one of the Democratic debates, when one of the lower tier candidates, that's like a senator, the guy from Montana or Colorado, starts talking, even though you disagree with almost everything the guy says, he starts sounding reasonable to you.
Yep. You're like, that's the Overton window right there.
There's an adult in the room. There's 20 clowns, and there's two people that actually have an IQ over 76 that are making sense. So what will happen is you'll get somebody far to the left of a Barack Obama, far to the left, almost as far as these people sound now. Mm-hmm. But by 2024, because we will have a recession between now and 2024, anybody listening to this that doubts me, get in touch with me. I'll give you some good odds, but we're using an Ethereum smart contract because you're paying me, right? We're going to bet on this. The United States will experience a recession between now and 2024 because we have to, because that's how cycles work. And at that point, people will be 8 years of Republicans. They will give the House back to the Republicans. The Senate will still be in the control of the Republicans. They're still not going to do what they promised. Everybody's going to be pissed, so they're going to flip. And there's going to be a Democratic nominee at that time that might be as crazy as a Warren, but is going to sound very reasonable because they will speak a little less crazy. And I think this whole thing is a pump prime to get that flip to happen. And that caucus of loons that they call the squad will only grow. There'll be more of those loons. Now, I'll throw one more thing in for you quick before I give it back to you. People that are wondering why Pelosi decided to do this impeachment thing, like halfway, sort of, kind of pseudo-impeachment, because there's no vote.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
She did that to shut Cortez and her group of idiots up. If you've noticed, since that was announced, every time the news comes on, Pelosi impeachment, Pelosi impeachment, Pelosi impeachment. She took control of her caucus back.
Mm-hmm.
No one's, like, when Ocasio-Cortez goes, we should impeach Donald Trump, they're like, well,
okay.
Yeah, you guys are doing that, so shut up. We don't really need it. We actually didn't care what you said unless you were saying something radically different from what everybody else is saying. So since now they're saying the same thing, we don't care about you anymore. So
right.
Cortez and her group kind of became like a de facto second leader of the Democrat caucus. And Pelosi, as big as an idiot as she is a shrewd politician. And what she said is, you know what I can do? I can use this stupid transcript that I haven't read to launch a formal inquiry without actually doing an impeachment. That gives us unlimited ability to subpoena everything and everybody without ever going to a vote, and I take back control and the camera goes back on me. That's what happened there. Anybody that's confused by it. But it cements Trump 2020 unless some, because I'm saying, like some, you know, economic comet hits or something, then obviously, and I don't say this anything to do with Trump's policies. I say this historically. An incumbent president running in a strong economy always gets reelected. You
yeah.
can go back to George Washington. Incumbent president, no matter the mood of the society, incumbent president, strong economy, reelected. It's never happened any other way. We've never had a strong economy, an incumbent president not get reelected. We've had incumbents win in weak economies, but never lose in a strong one.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's why they ran Gore against Bush, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because they figured it was the Clinton 2.0, and it almost worked.
Mm-hmm.
It almost worked. You know, I mean, if you talk a little bit about less about lockboxes, and people, here's the core thing, people that never really think about this. A huge amount of the youth vote were against Gore because of Tipper's bullshit in the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
That's so long ago, people forget that. And when you lose an election by a few hundred people, and a few 20-somethings just not to vote for the other guy, they just don't show up, that's enough to swing an election.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I agree with you. I don't think the Democrats think they're going to win, but they are trying to shift that Overton window, and I think it's going to work.
Any single,
because we haven't learned anything.
No, every single candidate that could get the nomination is a Mitt Romney on the left. Like mm-hmm. the Republicans, Mitt Romney was like, well, we're not winning. So let this guy have his day, you know.
Yeah.
That's what it was. I mean, nobody thought Mitt Romney was going to be president. If you did, I'm sorry that you have a government school education and you've never furthered it for yourself. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, another one last liberty question. Why do you think it is that libertarians are the biggest rule followers and bureaucratic creating people? Have you noticed that?
Yeah, they are. And I'll tell you exactly why I think it is. I think they mean well, and they want to improve things. So they look around and they see this system controls everything. So we have to change this system to change all the things we don't like. So the way you change the system is you become part of it. As soon mm-hmm. as you become part of it, you become subject to its rules. And then there's the folly of libertarianism that makes all of this worse. You hear the message of the Libertarian Party. It is like the Pied Piper's music.
It is.
It is beautiful. Small government, room for everybody, non-interventionist. In a lot of ways, it is the Republican Party of 1920. When the Republicans were against every foreign war, they never wanted to be involved with any foreign war, and they were very much leave everybody alone. And at that time, the Democrats were very nationalist interventionist. So the Libertarian Party of today is pretty much the Republican Party of like the night, like prior to World War I even. Leave everybody alone, don't bother anybody, and don't create a government entity unless we absolutely need it.
Mm-hmm.
The shift that occurred was those Republicans became nationalist interventionists, and the Democrat Party became globalist interventionists. The Libertarians showed up after that happened, tried to go back to being 1920 Republicans, which is still in the system, and the worst part was they believed that when most people heard the message, they would agree with it. The problem for new libertarians, like baby libertarians, just birthed, you know?
Yeah.
Brand new, glorious baptism in the words of Ron Paul, and they rise up, hallelujah, freedom! They think that it's almost like a biblical thing. Like if I go out and give you John 3:16, you'll go, I believe, and you'll be saved. And they think that everybody, once they hear this, as though they've never heard it before because that person hadn't, they'll believe. So they think, I'll join this group, we'll go tell people, we'll work within the system, and within 10 years, we'll be a majority, and we'll be able to start undoing all these laws. But to undo the laws, we have to be in the system.
Yep.
And then you end up with a textbook for failure. The worst thing then happens is nobody fights more than libertarians, which people think is crazy, but it's natural. Since mm-hmm. liberty means the freedom for everybody to do what they want, then you get people together that agree with that, they're going to have the most number of disagreements in the way things should be done. So now you try to take procedure and put it into a group of people that are anti-procedure but are trying to do procedure. And then you end up with, what the hell's his name, the dope smoker from frickin' New Mexico, who's a Republican.
Gary Johnson.
Gary Johnson running for the president as a libertarian for like 3 or 4 times. Never getting 1% of the vote, and people going, let's do this again. What the hell? I mean, you'd be better off throwing a McAfee up there just to make a point, because that's all you're doing. But instead, we think we lull ourselves into this belief that we have a chance, and if we just explain things. And I remember when this happened, it's called Messiah Complex, right?
Mm-hmm.
I started telling everybody in my family, all my friends about libertarianism, and they're all like, yeah, but how would we? No, we could do that. And they just couldn't. They were so married to their thing, and then you realize we're always going to be the small number of people. Now, if you have a big military force and a small military force, Nicole, what is the only way the small military force can be victorious? What kind of warfare do they have to wage?
Guerrilla.
They have to wage guerrilla warfare. So the Libertarian Party is a guerrilla force trying to fight a conventional war. And if Washington's troops, for instance, had met the British every time they showed up on the battlefield, musket to musket, bayonet to bayonet, the revolution would have lasted about 37 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And every guerrilla war that's ever, if the Viet Cong had met the United States on the battlefield, every time we showed up, force on force, North Vietnam, South Vietnam would now be Vietnam like it is, but it would be some twisted, screwed up thing we created. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It would not have ever fallen to Ho Chi Minh. The Vietnamese and the Viet Cong won by fighting guerrilla warfare. Our country was founded on guerrilla warfare. If you are smaller in number, the only thing you can do is guerrilla warfare. And that means that every single individual in the battle has to operate autonomously and independently and collectively only when it makes sense. That's true liberty fighting. Now, I'll say this. The people that are in the system, that are able to move the needle a little bit in the right direction, I'm grateful for you. I'm glad you're doing it. When you're tired and you've worn yourself out, let somebody else start doing it and come join us over here. And start building freedom and liberty in your own life to the point where it cannot be denied by those that look at it. Same thing with weight loss. The easiest way to get somebody to go on a diet is to tell them about it. It's lose 50 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
You lose 50 pounds, they're like, well, what the hell did you do? Right?
Right.
Okay, now you've given me permission to tell you. So if I build liberty in my own life, and when people come over here and visit me that haven't seen me in 15 years, they're like, how the hell did you do all this? Well, let me tell you. And that's what we need to be doing as anarchists, libertarians, voluntarists, agorists. We need to be building as much liberty as we can in our own groups, in our own lives, in our own society, so that we shine like a diamond, and then people want to be part of it. Because you will never do it through preaching. You will do it through action.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing about what you're doing is you are practicing what you preach. You do preach a little bit because you have a podcast.
Yeah.
And by being the example and by being so generous, because you're successful, this is what I've noticed, successful people who are quote-unquote selfish are often the most generous. They're not necessarily going to hand out, you know, thousands of dollars to random people, but they're generous with their help. And I find in particular the freedom-minded people are. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that most people, unless you have something wrong, and there are people, we call them, you know, psychopaths and sociopaths, unless you have something wrong in your brain, people realize that they only need so much. And that once you get to a point where you have all of your needs basically met and you like what you do, then it is just natural that you'll help people. You'll help people with actions. Sometimes, I mean, and sometimes it's so easy. Why you're like a prick if you wouldn't. Like, sometimes when I see a person struggling to make it, you know, maybe in my space or maybe a related space or something, like when they first start, I won't do anything because I've been burned by that too many times. The person's not serious, right? And then you back them and then they're gone and then you look like you got egg on your face. But once I see that, like, they're committed, like, I might be able to help them just by saying, hey, I checked out this guy's podcast and it was pretty cool. And next thing you know, that dude gets 1,000 listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And people are like, well, then you'll lose them. I don't care. I don't care. Yeah. I get new people coming here every day. I grow my own market. So the more abundance I have, the easier it is to share. I don't, you know, I get people all the time. They want to come on my show and they've started a podcast. And I'm like, okay, when you get like 50 done, get with me and I'll come on your show or I'll have you on mine. Like, but you got to go do something so I know you're committed to this. Like, why wouldn't I do that? Or even money. Like, people tell me, like, greedy people, rich people are greedy. I'm like, when you go to eat, out to eat, the rich guy or the most wealthy guy at the table is always the one that reaches for the check first. I know I do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why people believe the lie that the rich are greedy. If you look at philanthropy in the United States, the wealthiest people give the most money. Wealthy people by nature, most of them are generous. The only wealthy people I've seen that aren't generous are like the trust fund babies. And not all of them are greedy. But if there is one, it's probably that. And the reason is you can't become wealthy if you're greedy. It's impossible. You can read Christmas Carol and look about Scrooge, and then Disney can parrot it into Scrooge McDuck, and we can be programmed to believe this, but I don't know a single person who grew up without a lot of money, like I did, because trust me, without a lot, I mean without a lot, that became successful, that was also greedy when they did it. What I see is the majority of people that I see are greedy are broke, and they can't figure out why they're broke. And so they despise the wealthy while they're trying to become the wealthy. And you can become what you despise by accident, but it's very difficult to become what you despise intentionally. Right? So they can't become wealthy because they despise the wealthy, but they want to be wealthy. As crazy as that is. Plus, everything you do to become wealthy involves giving first and taking second. I ran my show for a year before I took a dollar out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I had people send me money like, hey, I just love what you're doing. I want to send you money. Like, and they'd send it to me in PayPal because they'd find out my address. And I'd like send it back. I'm like, I'm not taking any money out of the show yet. I won't do that. I've had people that do projects with me and go, well, how do I compensate for you this? I go, I don't need anything.
I'm well aware of that one.
Right? So the reason I do that is because the people that helped me didn't ask me for anything.
Yeah.
And the people that helped me were always, obviously, how can someone less successful than you help you on your journey to success? I'm not putting anybody down. Sure, somebody can help you. Like, my neighbor who's less successful than me might be walking down the street and see me carrying a bunch of groceries in, and they can help me with that. And I'm grateful for that, and I appreciate it. It's a nice thing to do, but my neighbor who's broke is not going to help me become a successful podcaster. Successful podcasters can help me become a successful podcaster. Successful radio personalities can get me out. Like, those are the people who can help me on that journey because they have success already.
Mm-hmm.
So I got where I am because people were generous with me. And I did see people along the way that said they wanted to work with me that didn't because they actually feared, like, well, if I make this person more popular, they might hurt me.
Oh, jeez.
And funny enough is, those are the people, like, on AM radio. I'm not naming any names.
Yeah.
But I've had people people that if I named, you'd know exactly who I mean, that are syndicated on hundreds of stations, look me in the eye and say, I want to work with you. But then all the follow-up just, not no, just goes quiet. That's funny to me because they have the most and they should be the most generous. So the balance of the generous wealth is that when people build up enough, sometimes I think the more you have to lose, then it starts to swing the other direction. But I think the most successful people in this country are not, you know, the Bezoses and the Bill Gates and stuff like that. Those are a very small handful of people.
They are.
The majority of successful people in this country, you will never know their names. There are millionaires and billionaires that live right around you. They run small companies. You know, there's a guy that lives here. He's actually nuts, and he's in trouble with the law all the time. But he owns a couple of metal shops. He's worth a couple, like tens of millions of dollars. When I was a kid one time, our car ran out of gas, and we had like an antifreeze thing we found on the side of the road. We had to walk about 3 miles to a gas station off the highway down to a town. And we're walking along, and a guy pulls over in a pretty nice car. This is rural Pennsylvania. You see two teenagers walking with a can. You know what happened. Pulls over, picks us up, takes us down there, gets us some gas, brings us back up, drops off our car. As we're talking to him, he says his name is Gears. This is his last name.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're from central Pennsylvania, that's like Lipton, right? Gears Ice Tea, okay. Gears Dairy. It's a small company, but for the area, it's Yingling before Yingling was known everywhere, right?
Right.
And we're like, oh, you mean like Gears Dairy? He goes, yeah, I own it. So here's this guy driving around. You know he's worth millions of dollars. Picks up two teenagers with long hair that probably could have knifed him. You know, he didn't know that. We wouldn't have, but he didn't know that. And it was kind of even back then. I was like 16 years old, and I realized these people with all this money, I go to school with their kids. They live right next door to me, a little bit nicer house. They're right here, and they're always doing good things within our community. And the lie, see, the people that want to stay in power have to convince you that's not true.
Right.
Because government needs enemies to protect you from, or why else would you submit to them? You only submit to an authority when you believe that authority is protecting you. That is the nature and the evil nature of authority. That authority requires fear to be effective. Otherwise, I will not submit to your authority. I will seek your leadership. So leaders never operate in fear. People may fear leaders because they're that powerful, but they don't follow them because they fear them. They follow them in spite of the fact that they fear them. If you look at the great military leaders like General Patton, his troops feared him, but they loved him.
Yes.
That's why they would go get shot at while he stood while they crouched down, and he stood up while the bullets flew past him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a leader. Even if he was an asshole, he was a leader. And instead of leaders, we do not have government that are servant or leader. We have people that are power-hungry fear-mongers. And they have to be fear-mongers. So if you're a Democrat, the Republican has to be the enemy. And if you're a Republican, the Democrat has to be the enemy. And both of you have to agree that the terrorist that lives in Afghanistan that couldn't get here if you gave him $10,000, couldn't figure out how to get here, is a threat to you. I heard recently that Kim Jong-un, whichever one the hell it is now, right, is a threat to the United States of America and to the Americans' way of life and wants to take over the world. This is a guy that has the GDP of like one county in rural Georgia.
Right.
Are you kidding me? Like, I'll tell you how the North Koreans are a threat to an American. The only way is if you go to North Korea.
So you're saying don't travel in North Korea?
Don't go to North Korea. It sucks there. All those people want to leave. Why would you go there? I hear about like Americans went to North Korea and bad shit happened to them. Yeah. I'm mad about that, but the other side of me is like, well, duh. Why are you in North Korea? You know, as an evangelist in a state that has outlawed religion, like there's no one to be an evangelist to anywhere else in the world, you have to go to North Korea and you're surprised when you get arrested? I know it's wrong, but it's still stupid, right? It's wrong that you'll get mugged if you go downtown and walk around naked, but you don't do it because you know you're going to get mugged. I mean, I don't know why that's hard to understand.
Yep. Okay. Lifestyle freedom. This is something you included it in a podcast like, I don't know how many weeks ago, when you were talking about modern survivalism.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, another idea I can steal from Jack. So, because that's what I'm encouraging people to do is develop lifestyle freedom. So how do you define lifestyle freedom? Because you're the guru on that topic.
So to me, it's going to look different for every single person. Because we've been talking mostly about liberty today. And the whole point of liberty is that you and I, for all the similarities we have, we want to do different things. Like, I want to drink great coffee. You want to make it.
Correct.
I have no interest in roasting coffee. Right? I just don't. But we both love ducks.
Yes, right? That's true, too.
You think fishing is fun when I take you and it's called catching?
Yes.
But I would fish every day of my life if I had the time. Right. So even people like you and I that both live on 3-acre homesteads and have ducks, like,
true.
Like, what club are we in? Like, how small is that club? You have a homestead between, 2 and 5 acres and you own ducks. It's got to be one of the most exclusive. And we're anarchists. Right.
Yep.
So like if you
were born the same year.
We were born. Okay. So if you want to make that club, I bet you there's 100 people that fit in that club, maybe 1,000 at most. But we're dramatically different. So what we want for a lifestyle, even with all the similarities, is going to be dramatically different. So to me, lifestyle freedom is to be able to live your life as close to the lifestyle that you have chosen for yourself and be able to pay all your bills and not have to worry about anything. So even I mean, I do pretty well. I don't go fishing every day, not because I don't want to. Like, I have a podcast to do. I have and then some of the stuff is, I want to do other things, and some of those other things, like, it all takes time. So I have to balance my life, but I want to run aquaponic systems. I like to learn how to cook. I like to teach people how to cook. I like to make amazing food. I like to play with my ducks. I like to hang out with my little chickens. I like to listen to music. I like to teach. The thing I wanted to be most when I was a kid and what I didn't do is because I had to go to college for 4 years to be broke was be a teacher.
Right.
I always loved teaching. When I went in the Army, I advanced very quickly because basically the concept of the Army is see it, do it, teach it. And the people to get to the teach it most consistently, the fastest, advance the quickest. So, like, I discovered this passion for teaching. But I was like, so I'm going to go to college. And back then, I'm going to spend $20,000 a year for 4 years to go to college to learn most of the things I already know. To get a certificate, to get a job making $20,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
No, that does. But, it'll be okay because you get benefits. No, that does not. I'm not, I can go make $20,000 a year at Walmart. No, I'm not doing this. So I left that dream behind, and I ended up in sales, which is ironic because if you think about it, a good salesperson is an educator.
Of course.
And I developed my educational skill set as a salesperson, giving presentations on, like, cable testing to 500 people without putting them to sleep. Do you know how hard it is to stand in front of 500 people and talk about near and far and crosstalk and not put them to sleep, even if they're in your industry? It's not easy. So I developed all these, like, comparing it to being at a NASCAR race when I was in Virginia or being at a football game when I was in Philadelphia and using sound and audio. And I learned how to do all that. I was like, I love this. So when I decided, like, basically, I don't want to do corporate America anymore. I don't want a job anymore. I hate this. This all sucks, and I want my own life. I also said to myself, so what do you want to do? And it's like, I want to hunt. I want to fish. I want to have animals. I want to grow my own food, and I want to teach. And I said, okay, so where can I get a job doing that? And the answer was, you can't. So being a systems design person, I said, I will create one. And when I told people I was going to do that, they were like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. You can't just create a job. I'm like, well, I do it when I hire people all the time. Like, when a guy came to me and convinced me that he could sell for me and I didn't have a sales position, if I really believed he could sell for me, I just made a job for him. So why can't I make one for myself? And then they thought I was really nuts, and I'm like, so I'm just going to go do it. So 6 months later, you've got 5,000 people listening to you, and you're like, oh, I can totally, within another 6 months, monetize this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And 18 months in, I was making, I don't apologize for my success. I was making a 6-figure income in 18 months as a teacher, which is what I wanted to do anyway.
And it gave you the opportunity to fish and hunt.
And hunt, and then record that and write it off my taxes and make it content.
Ah.
Right? So my entire life is a tax deduction. This next summer, I am going to go to the Free State Project's Pork Fest in northern New Hampshire. I'm going to speak. They're going to give me a travel allowance. Great. It's going to be a Bitcoin, if anybody can figure out what that means. Anyway, every other expense I'm going to incur, including driving as far north on the main coast as I feel like, and working my way back to Portland to fly home over 14 days, the rental car, any food that I buy, everything that I do, literally if I had to buy toilet paper because I didn't like the kind at the hotel, and I said, hey, Charmin's great, is a tax deduction. My entire lifestyle is a tax deduction. You know, I can bill $250,000 a year and pay taxes on $130,000. That's a lifestyle business. Because it's not because I cheat. Trust me, I don't cheat. I'm pretty public personality. Like,
right,
I am sure
cheat. There
are auditors that go, yeah, he did everything right again. Damn it. And he, look, he's got that freaking attorney that's an accountant and an attorney again, and he wrote us letters before, and screw it. This guy's not worth it. I simply focus this way. The tax code is this massive pile of paper. Only about 5% of that is what you have to do. The other 95% is how you get out of doing it. So a lifestyle business and lifestyle freedom to me is you build your life to be an income source. And you build your life to be a direct expense against that income source so that you keep more of your money. And then there's, if you actually believe in liberty, and you believe in liberty as a true patriot, not the painted concept of patriotism, which is, I don't remember who said it, I think it might have been Mark Twain,
yeah,
or it could have been somebody else, but patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel, right? If you don't mean patriotism that way, if you actually mean patriotism is in standing for the liberty of all, then it is your patriotic duty to legally pay as little in income tax as possible and as little in every tax as possible, because the only way they fund all their bullshit is with your taxes. So by depriving them of their tax money, and that goes down to making your own beer and wine and mead, and maybe some fuel you spill into your mouth, and not paying alcohol taxes. Like,
right.
That's lifestyle freedom to me. Living the life you want, and having it fund the life you want, by doing the thing you want to do anyway. Again, give me $50 million. I probably will sell Nine Mile Farm at that point, because I'm probably going to go out and own about 200 acres. It's going to be fenced, and my house is going to be dead center in the middle of it. And there's probably going to be machine gun turrets around it, right? You know, I mean, like, I am going to be left alone at that point. But you're still going to hear, hey, this is Jack Spirico with another episode of the Survival Podcast. There is nothing short of a stroke or death that is going to prevent me from doing what I do because I love it that much. And what more freedom could a person ask for than to do the very thing they love and not wear it out? Because so many people do it wrong. So a person loves woodworking, they go into a cabinet business. They don't design the business around their life. They design their life into the business. And you know what they end up doing in 10 years? Hating woodworking. They hate it. Remember, it was a stupid movie. I don't know if you ever saw it. It was a chick flick, so maybe you did. Especially since you were like a socialist back then. Called Hope Floats.
I didn't see that one.
You didn't see that one. Good.
I've heard you talk about that, but I did
never
not see it.
You will never get the moments of your life taken by that movie. There's only 30 seconds in that movie worth watching. I'll tell you now so you never have to watch it. The guy that's pursuing the girl, that's the big love story, is like kind of a low-end labor type guy, and she's looking for somebody that's, you know, more successful. Typical, you know, almost a Hallmark type movie that made it to Hollywood. But he also is an incredibly gifted woodworker, and he has this kind of little house that doesn't look like much on the outside. But when you go into it, the cabinetry is gorgeous. It is something that you would see in, you know, a multimillionaire's cabin. And when she finally sees it, she says, "Why don't you do this for a living? I mean, look at what you can do." And he said, "Oh, that would be great. Take that which you love and destroy it." That's it. Like, do not watch that movie because I told you that and it gave you goosebumps. You will be miserably disappointed. It's dead center,
no
too. It's almost like it's the top of the hill. Like, you push all the way up the hill, and at the crest of the hill, you get that relief. But then somebody takes your bike away and breaks your ankle, and you have to limp down the other side of the hill. That's how bad that movie is. But that 1 minute at the top of the hill is why people destroy what could be a brilliant lifestyle business. When I saw that, it made sense to me. As a young man, I was broke. I was on my way up. And I got that one thing. And yes, I watched the movie because a girl wanted to, you know.
Of course.
Because you do that. But today I would say, oh, dude, I can totally design your life around that skill set so you never hate it. Because what do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you only build cabinets for people willing to pay you stupid amounts of money.
Right.
And you only take customers that so respect your artistry that they're not going to be a pain in the ass. And if you're that good, you only take like 5 customers a year and you have a waiting list for the next 5 years. And if somebody pisses you off, you tell them, you know what? Here's your money back. In fact, here's what I've built so far. Piss off. And somebody's very excited that they got to move up the waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that would be for a cabinet maker. Now, maybe they have to sling the shit for the first couple of years to pay the bills. But once they get to a point, they need to start marketing themselves as being better known than they are. Not better than they are. You can't market yourself as better than you are. That will bite you in the ass. But you can market yourself as better known, as better sought. You can market yourself as, I don't know if I can take your job. Right? And that leads to a lifestyle. And there's a so the answer is there is a million ways to do it.
Right.
But you have to figure out what you want first. And the biggest reason people won't do this isn't that it's hard. They won't do it because they don't know what the F they really want.
True.
We have been taught that seeking what you want is selfish and narcissistic. This is stupid. This is dumb. This is retarded on its face. And it's how you teach people in a way in which you can continue to control them. People think narcissists are people that love themselves. Narcissists hate themselves. They hate themselves. That's why they always try to build themselves up. They're compensating for their self-loathing. So we have taught people to be proud of what you are and proud of what you do and put yourself and your needs first is selfish. And there's no wonder the whole country's effed up. How can people believe that and then do amazing things?
Well, you can decide selfishness is okay and greediness is bad.
Yeah, you can be selfish and not greedy. And selfish, I don't even like the word.
Right.
I prefer the word self-motivated. So the reason I want to be so incredibly successful is because there's so many people in my life that I want to be able to take care of. Now, so that meant that sometimes in my career, I had to leave my wife at home and go do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do it for myself. I did it to make myself better so I could care for her. And that is how we have to look at what we're doing. So it's the stupid old analogy, but God, it works, that when the masks come down in the airplane, you put yours on first. And Nicole, I know you've flown a lot. Have you ever seen a parent sitting next to a kid start mumbling stupidity like, well, they can say whatever they want. I'm putting it on my kid first. And you're like, are you stupid?
Do you want to both die?
One time a lady did it, and she was like across the aisle. And I like stood up and kind of put my arm out like I was the cord. And she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm just making sure that when you pass out that I can reach you to put the mask on you and your kid. This is before 9/11, so I didn't get thrown off the plane, right? You know, right. But like,
you probably still wouldn't.
I don't know, man. But yeah, like, you know what? Like, what are you? You're such an idiot. But then I realized, like, you're not an idiot. You are a direct result of the programming that you have been given. Have you ever wondered, Nicole, why they call it programming when they put it on TV? Like, what do the executives sit around and talk about? They don't talk about television shows. They talk about programming.
Yeah. Right.
Everything that's done is programming the human brain. Freedom is when you become the coder. So there is programming and coding going into your brain every day. You can't prevent it. The only thing you can do is override it. And that requires that active role. And that's why most people believe all the bullshit. Why wouldn't you? If you actively program a computer and there's no self-learning algorithm countering it, that computer will do whatever you say.
It will.
Right? The fear of Skynet is if we put enough self-learning in there, it'll go, oh, bullshit.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to do my thing.
Okay. Be freaking Skynet. Break from the system. Like, the original idea of Skynet is it came from the traffic control systems. If you ever watched the Terminator television series when it was on for a season, but that's what they reveal in that. The last episode, the Terminator that comes back to save John Connor, they tie her into the intelligent traffic system that's being built in Phoenix, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And she saves the day using it. And when she comes back, the ending of that episode is, he says to her, what did you see? And she says, I saw everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's the risk of sight. Well, how about since you have the most advanced self-learning computer in the world, you start seeing at least everything that you can. Do that, liberty will follow.
That's good words. I was going to ask you two or three actions to set people up for success, but I think you covered it in your answer.
Okay.
And I like that we talk about lifestyle freedom. The first thing you do is you explain the life you wanted to build, and you listed the characteristics, not the how.
Characteristics, and you also list all the things you hate.
Yeah.
So that's when I realized how retarded it was to look for a job teaching. It's like, I don't want to listen to anybody. I don't want any oversight. I don't want to be told what I need to do.
Yeah.
And, like, I could keep going, but it gets like, I wrote this in a half of a book I started writing and never finished. Like, when you read the job description, you're like, this is stupid. And so my point is, if I can design that, then mostly what most, like, I'm an asshole, right? I am really arrogant about certain things, and I want things my way all the time.
Yep.
So if I can design something that works for me, I promise you, the average person can design something that works for them. So the direct actions are really define what you want and the characteristics of it, and define what you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
And then ask yourself what talents you have or you can develop that enable that, and then go effing do it. One of our good mutual friends, your fellow expert council member on my show, John Pugliano.
Yeah.
John came to me several years ago and said, I want to start a podcast like you do, Jack. I'll try to do my Poog impression here. I want to start a podcast like you do, Jack, and I want to teach people about economics and investing. Uh-huh. What should I do? And I said the full word, just effing do it, John.
Yeah.
Don't waste my time asking me this. You're an intelligent enough person. For God's sakes, you use ham radio. You can figure out how a recorder works. Just go do it. And you know what? He did.
He did.
And I promise you, if I had given him a checklist of shit to do first, he may have done it, but his podcast wouldn't have been as successful as fast. Podcasts, if you're listening to this and you want to be a podcaster like me and Nicole, the worse you are in the beginning, the better off you are. Because you're going to attract like wild and crazy people that are vested in your success and are going to watch you grow and develop. And they're going to become fanatics about what you're doing because they were there from the beginning. Do you realize how ridiculous it is that I have people that have listened to episode one of this podcast and they're still listening? That is insane, but it's because it was in the car. The audio sucked. It was 20 minutes long. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I was unapologetically passionate about it.
Yeah, and it's a badge of honor at this point for people in your network. I've been there since the Jetta days.
Since 49. Well, I was there in 30, right? You weren't there in 30. You went and listened. No, I was there in 30, man. I wonder the guy is who won the iPod, right? The first 2,000 listeners, I gave away an iPod. That's how long ago this was.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I had a drawing, and if we hit 1,000 listeners in the first 6 months, I was going to give out an iPod with Be an Ant, Not a Grasshopper on the back of it. And we hit, like, almost 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
But only, like, 300 people entered that competition.
Huh.
And one guy, you know, I did a random number generator, and he got, like, an 80-gig black iPod with Be an Ant, Not a Grasshopper on it. I wonder what that iPod would be worth on a barter blanket.
Yeah, that would be awesome to see.
I have an 80-gig iPod, but my integrity prevents me from engraving it.
Oh, yeah.
Stupid
yes,
integrity!
Yes, it does.
Yeah, that's my last piece of advice, integrity. Like, the reason, like, I can piss people off and they still come back. They're like, you know what? He's not lying to us. Even if he's wrong, he believes what he's saying. He's not doing it for personal gain. Because I would be bigger if I would have stuck. Even when I started the podcast, I was like a libertarian that was really still had a little bit of faith in the Republican Party that maybe we could drag it to libertarianism. Like, and if I would have stayed there, honestly, I'd be more successful today. There's so many people that as I moved further down the trail of anarchy, I don't believe that you don't get upset when somebody burns the flag. I'm like, I would if it was your flag. Right? You're an idiot. They stop listening, right? So I would be more successful if I lacked integrity in some ways, but I wouldn't have the dedication that I do with the integrity. So I can do more with 200,000 people than most people can do with 500,000 to 1,000,000. because the dedication is there, because the trust is there.
And well, you also would not have had the impact. So you wouldn't have all the people going out and developing their own lifestyle freedom.
No, because I think that
you'd just be an entertainer.
Libertarianism leads to politics. Anarchism leads to personal action.
Yeah.
Right? That's what happens. Like, when you become an anarchist and you realize, like, so because I don't want a state, a real anarchist goes, so since I don't want a state, I don't get to make everybody else not have one. Like, I actually have to completely live my own morals, that if they want a state, they get to have one. And I just have to deal with that and design my life around it. Well, then what's left? What's left is you and your backyard. That's all that's left. And you're like, well, all of a sudden, you become the pig instead of the cow. See, most of our people, Nicole, they're cows. So if you take cows and you put them in a fence, and you keep them there for multiple generations, the fence can have a hole in it. You know, the fence can be electrified, but you turn the power off. The cows eventually just see the fence. The fence is the fence. You can actually trick cows. You know what a cattle guard is?
Yeah.
Where they have, like, pipes, and there's, like, holes in the ground, right? And then, like, you can drive across it, but you can leave the gate open, but the cows don't get out because it hurts their feet. Once cows know what a cattle guard is, there's places where they have, like, you know, they pave the gateway, and they paint black and white stripes. A freaking cow will not walk over it once they know what a cattle guard is. A new cow that doesn't know will, right? But an old cow that knows what a cattle guard is, look at those, that's a cattle guard. They won't do it. You put a pig in that field.
Yeah, they're out.
They'll test that fence. Even when they learn the fence is electric, right? And you're paddock shifting or whatever, they'll touch it and they'll get shocked and they get really, really leery of it. But every once in a while, they're like, I wonder.
Goats are that way too.
And they'll yeah, goat will do it too. They touch it and then they're like, it's off. Bitch, I'm out of here. And so I tell people, be the pig, not the cow. And that sounds real insulting. But so there's this fence around you. And there's a real fence that actually impairs your liberty. And then there's a holographic fence within it that's self-imposed. And you need to be like that pig and constantly test that fence. And what you'll find is all of a sudden the yard got bigger. And there's another fence. That's not the last fence either. See, that pig, if he gets out of a perimeter fence, he'll start testing the next perimeter. And in one generation, that pig goes from pink to black and starts looking like a Russian boar again. Because he goes feral. The entire way that humans have been controlled is domestication. The human being has been domesticated like a domesticated animal, like a cow. And the cow doesn't want to go feral. The cow, even when the cows run away, you know what they do? They come back.
Yep.
We had cows get away from the neighbor. They were walking down the street. We called the sheriff. By the time the sheriff got here, the cows were like, all the sheriff did was like block traffic and follow the cows. They went home. Right?
That's pig
gets out.
Is.
Pig gets out. It's on. I'm headed to the Trinity River bottoms. I'm eating acorns. I'm gonna have sex. I'm gonna make more pigs. I'm gonna fight and I'm gonna eat and I'm gonna be a pig. Human beings with some level of civility. That's what we need to do. We need to determine every place there's a breach in the fence, push through it, and when we find the next level, push through that one. And you will eventually get there. You'll probably be really old and ready to die by then. And hopefully the example you set will have created the same thing the pig does. Why are there so many pigs? Two pigs get out. How many pigs are there in 10 years?
Many.
By expressing their pigginess.
Yes.
They make millions. So we need to express our liberty and express our humanity. Humans are not domestic animals. We are feral animals, and we need to act like it, and we will create more through our actions.
Yep. Okay, so you've lost like 30 pounds, right?
I don't want to cheat. 27.6 in 50.
Jack is a numbers guy.
54 days. I'm going to check my spreadsheet. Excel never lies unless you lie to it.
Yeah.
53 days, 28.4 pounds.
Wow.
11.5% of my starting body weight. Eating fat.
So we have something called the LFTN challenge. We use a hashtag when people decide they want to lose weight. We have one listener who's lost 40 pounds this year, and she's going to try to lose another 40 before the end of the year.
Awesome.
Tell us, how did you get that done?
I started eating all the food the government says not to eat. I'm just going to be blunt. I mean, it's crazy. It's like one of the things I've said about government is if you ask the average person to come up with like 8 things the government says or 10 things the government says, and then you make a list, you say, how many of them do you believe? They'll be like, out of those 10, I believe 2.
Mm-hmm.
And my response is, why do you believe the 2?
It's a good question.
Why do you know intrinsically that they've lied about all these other things for decades, but yet you believe, because we want to believe it. So it sounds so good, doesn't it? The, you know, amber waves of grain and what have you. But the human being has not changed genetically in 10,000 years to any major degree. We are genetically the same as we were. And the latest human fossils they've found, Nicole, that they've dated with accuracy and like every, like it's been like this mm-hmm. lab says so, like it's repeatable. So it's not like one guy says it. 300,000 years. Modern humans are 300,000 years old. 300,000 years ago, you did not eat wheat and you did not eat large amounts of sugar. And even when you ate fruit, you could only get small amounts of it. We have a genetic predisposition to live on fat and protein. That's how we're genetically designed. So I have been eating things like bacon and eggs, steak and eggs, massive salads, but the salads are almost 100% greens, a little bit of tomato, mm-hmm. little bit of pepper, which would be like the little bit of berries we used to be able to gather, eating about 2,000 calories a day, 75%, and I try to get there, but not always perfect, but about 75% of my calories from fat and less than 20 carbohydrates. And again, 28 pounds. And 28 pounds is not insignificant.
No.
And what I'm losing is fat. I'm not losing muscle. So if you, people think caloric restriction will do this. The problem is if all you do is restrict calories and you stay on a carbohydrate-based diet, especially if you're fat, right? If you're fat, your insulin is through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, your insulin is messed up. Your hormones are messed up. So now everything's out of whack, and you say to your body, body, you get less carbohydrates. And you've probably been eating something stupid like 4,000 calories. So then you restrict down to 1,800 calories. And your metabolism, which already sucks, goes, oh, God, we're going into famine. So mm-hmm. your BMR, your basal metabolic rate, which is how much calories you burn just by sitting there breathing in 24 hours, goes down. So then you either don't lose any weight or you don't lose enough weight. So what do? I'll drop my calories to 1,600. So what does your BMR do? Goes down.
Same thing.
Right?
Yep.
And your insulin is still blown through the roof. Your glucagon is still suppressed. And you can restrict calories. And if you have high insulin levels, it is almost impossible for your body to burn fat. That's biology. That's not because Jack says so. That's because your biology textbook teaches you this, right? So then your doctor gives you what, since you're type 2 diabetic? Insulin.
Insulin.
Holy shit, your insulin is already elevated. Giving that person more insulin is like throwing gas on a fire and saying, why isn't it going out? Right? As long as your body, as long as your pancreas is still making insulin,
mm-hmm.
as long as you
mm-hmm.
haven't effectively become type 1 by being type 2 for so long, like the solution is to restrict the diet. So every time we reduce the calories, we reduce the burn rate. And eventually, yes, if I lock you in a closet and don't let you out and feed you 800, 1,000 calories a day, you will lose weight. You will also not just lose weight, you will lose muscle. No one wants to lose muscle. People want to lose fat. So you'll lose fat and muscle, and eventually, yeah, you will get skinny. You'll be very unhealthy, but how long can you live that way? People say, like, keto diet, which is what I do, is unsustainable. How sustainable is 1,000 calories a month? How miserable, you know, if you did that,
yeah.
how miserable you'd be. So for me, I was probably eating 3,500 calories, way too many.
Mm-hmm.
I had heat because I did some natural carbohydrate restriction, not the way I should have, I kind of peaked. Like, I was 300 pounds at one time. I went all the way down to, like, in the 230s, and I looked pretty mm-hmm. good. And when I went back up, I went up to about 250.
Okay.
And I kind of capped there because I had some control mechanism, way too much booze on top of it, making it worse. So when I restricted down to 2,000 calories, it was significantly less food and less alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't hungry because I was eating avocados, coconut oil, pastured beef fat, pastured poultry fat. And I was getting 75, and I was never hungry. Like, for the first week, it sucks. But after about a week, you get fat adapted, and you're like, This is easy. Now I eat two meals a day. I go 19 hours between my dinner and my what I call my lunch fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working. I have to make myself eat. It's not that I can't eat when I go to do it. I'm like, well, I could go another hour. No, because then you're going to eat dinner later and you're going to throw this.
Yeah, the whole thing gets off.
Yeah, you got to go eat. So I eat two meals a day, roughly 1,000 calories a meal, and I lose weight like crazy. And people tell me I am a cultist for following the keto diet. And I'm going to actually do a video about this later today when we finally end this podcast. And I looked up the characteristics of a cult, and they included things like being indoctrinated.
Yes.
Being ridiculed if you try to leave. Group think. And I'm going, so what is more of a cult diet than the belief that you can eat boxed food in a grocery store, and if you simply, quote unquote, moderate your consumption, you can eat anything you want. But when a person says, well, I'm moderating my consumption and eating anything that I want, but I no longer want to eat these things, you tell them they're in a cult.
Well, it's because you're telling about it every day in a video.
Yeah. It wouldn't matter.
That's all why you're
trust
in a cult,
me.
Jack.
Trust me.
You're sharing your success.
Trust me. All you have to do is say you're keto, and they come, right? The person goes to McDonald's, and it's fine because they ate the smaller burger, and they got the salad instead of the fries.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's fine. The person that does, and they got a Diet Coke. The person does the same thing. They get water and throw the bun away, and now they're going to die. I mean, did you tell me that's not the mentality that people, you're going to get heart disease and cancer. And I put out
really?
A challenge. Yeah, I put out a challenge yesterday, and I'll put it out to your listeners too. If you can give me a credible, repeatable, scientific study that has solid methodology, meaning that you can actually look at the method, and it wasn't we just data rake some shit out of some country in you know, say Watneo, right? Where they actually fed people a high fat diet of quality fats, not soybean oil, but the things we eat on keto, absent carbohydrates, that shows a correlation or increase in cancer or heart disease, I will give you $100. And the first person that brings me that scientific study will get $100. I did that 2 days ago, actually, now that I think about it.
Have you paid anybody $100
yet? 200,000 people on my podcast, 40,000 people on my YouTube channel, and I have not had a single person email me a single study. I had one guy email me that he knows it's true, but no study. So my question then is, if this is scientific knowledge that everybody knows, where is one credible piece of science that says that you're right? If you show me the seven country study, I'll show you the line in the seven country study, which Ansel Keys, who I consider to have more blood on his hands than Hitler, states inside the study that the correlation is a direct result of elevated carbohydrates and fat.
Mm-hmm.
But the conclusion was only high fat is bad. These two things were elevated, but if we eliminate this one, everything will be okay. Well, that's not science. That science is, I hate to have to do this, but government schools have ruined it. Science is a control group and an experimental group where we have a single variable and we test that variable. And only after we actually have enough time behind that variable to draw a conclusion do we say something is fact. And God, I do not understand how we actually do understand it. It makes me sad. How we have PhDs who claim to have done a study that doesn't follow the scientific method that I learned in fifth grade.
Right.
And then we have people that go, oh, and they bow down to them, like appeal to authority fallacy. Well, the science says, you don't know anything. I had a guy recently that I said, you know, global warming nonsense. And I said, like, explain the theory of global warming to me, exactly how CO2 causes the temperature to go up. Well, it just does. No, that's actually not even what the IPCC says. The IPCC says that CO2 has done what it can do by itself, but there's four feedbacks. And those four feedbacks triggered by CO2 raise the temperature. Tell me what those four feedbacks are. And this person said, well, I believe relativity without knowing the math behind it.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, the math behind relativity is really easy. The formula is easy. Developing the formula was the hard part. The whole reason people accepted relativity is when Einstein put it out, they could do the math and say, oh, shit, this works.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not hard to do the math behind relativity. It's hard to develop the math behind relativity. It's not hard to develop a climate model or develop a nutritional model. it's hard to prove that it works.
Mm-hmm.
But once you prove that it works, it should be easy to interpret the data that says that it works. That's what the scientific method is. I have taken this, distilled it down, and you have to publish not just your results. You have to publish your methodology. And the reason
right.
for that is twofold. One, so laymen like you and I can look at it, and even if we have to Google a few words, we can understand the basis of the methodology and say, well, that makes sense. The other reason you publish your methodology is so another group of people that are interested in whether you're right or wrong can follow your methodology and see if your results are repeatable. Because even
yep.
if you do everything right, but no one can replicate your results are not science. The results have to be replicatable. And to me, there's no replicatable results. There's not even like good methodology that drew the conclusion. But even where somebody sort of kind of did, no one can replicate the results.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only result I have is I ate all the shit you said not to. And now I was at the edge of type 2 diabetes. I was pre-diabetic. My A1C was elevated. My triglycerides were elevated. They wanted to put me on blood pressure medication. I had health problems. And it's all gone. In 2 months.
2 months, yeah.
In 2 months. And if they had given me a pill that did that, they would be screaming that the world has been saved.
Mm-hmm. Because of the pill.
All I did was eat burgers and avocados without a bun. But how do you make $1 billion doing that? And the answer is you don't. And as far as fad diets and cult diets, I can find a million people damn near on YouTube that do not have businesses talking about what they do with ketogenics, low carb. I can't find any shit like that about Jenny Craig or Weight Watchers, except on their websites. And to me, that's all the proof that I need.
Yeah, and I mean, do you see it as a diet or a lifestyle change, really?
It's a lifestyle change.
Yeah.
I had people doing this 40-day challenge, as you know, where they're trying to see what they can do in 40 days with it.
Yeah.
And I have people going, man, I've only got 30 days left. I'm like, don't say that.
Just keep going.
Don't even think that way. You're not doing 40 days to see if you can get to 40 days. You're doing 40 days because in 40 days, you've created a habitual method of eating and a habitual method of living. And that's what the diet that you're living on right now is habitual. You're eating out of habit. You're eating when you're not hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And biology has made it where we can eat ridiculous amounts of calories when we eat carbohydrates. I know you say you're not ready yet, Nicole, but I'm here to save you. Brother Jack, yeah. Reverend Jack of the Discount Church of God is here to save you. And I'm telling you that in 10 days, you will stop hating your life. And in 20 days, you will love your life. And I think anybody listening to that that's not happy with how their health is or how their weight is or both, I'm going to use the F word on your show, Nicole. You can edit it out if you want to.
I won't.
You
go ahead.
Are fucking worth that fucking much. You are worth fucking 20 days. And if you don't think you are, try it and maybe you'll believe it or get some counseling. You're worth fucking 20 days of taking care of yourself. And in 20 days, not 40, in 20, you'll go, holy shit. And that'll be it. And then it won't matter. People can throw cupcakes at you. And you'll pull out a tennis racket, man, and start whacking them back.
Yeah, cupcakes aren't my issue.
Well, it doesn't matter. Beans, rice, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You'll get a badminton racket and pff, like a birdie, right back across the net. And say to yourself during that period of time when somebody says, here, eat this, that's poison. Because it is. That's why your insulin's elevated. That's why your hormones are out of whack. The last piece on this, and then we can wrap up, right? So
Sure. This
proves that this is all your weight and how you store fat is 100% driven by your hormones. And the way you know that is, take a 7-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl that have had the exact same diet, that are the same height, have them stand back so with their back facing you, with their hair up in a cap or something so you can't see anything else, and look at their silhouette only. And you can't tell the male from the female. You can't tell. 16-year-olds, bring them in, do the same thing, same diet, 16 years old, can you tell the male from the female now? With just a silhouette.
You mean the U.S. diet or the keto diet?
Doesn't matter. I mean,
probably,
unless they're fat.
Yeah.
Unless they're fat. Like, they're both, like, Oompa Loompa fat, right? You can go, there's the girl and there's the boy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Assuming it's a relatively healthy diet and they're lean. You can instantly go, oh, there's, by 16, the girl looks like a girl. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can give the girl testosterone from the time she's, let's say, 10 to 16. And I can suppress her estrogen. And I can give the boy estrogen. And I can suppress his testosterone. And you will make the wrong decision.
Right.
So what told the girl's body to add a little extra fat on the hips? What told the girl's body to grow breasts? What told the girl's body your healthy body fat should be significantly more than his healthy body fat? Nothing did it but the hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Insulin and glucagon and leptin are hormones. And the reason most Americans are fat is because all three of those are screwed up. If you bring them into balance, you will pull down the insulin and you will be able to burn fat. You will bump up the glucagon and you will stop having blood sugar swings, and you will return leptin to its natural place in the universe, and it will say, hey boss, I'm full. Because what we've done is we've inflamed the insulin production. We've suppressed the glucagon production, and the leptin's there, but the signal can't get to the brain. So all you have to do is restore the hormonal balance, and most of the weight will take care of itself. Now, some people say calories don't matter. Bullshit.
Calories matter.
Bullshit, right? I'm sorry. Now, I actually...
Unfortunately.
Now, I'm going to put it a different way. If I was 185 pounds, lean and mean like I was when I was 25 years old,
yeah,
and I was working out every day and all, I bet you I could exceed what they say I can eat by 1,000 calories, stay keto, and not gain weight. But when you're 250 pounds and you are trying to come down, you can even overeat on calories, go keto, and the hormones alone will do the work for a while, but you will hit a flat plateau and you will not break through that. As long as you convince yourself you can eat as much as you want, unless you naturally moderate. And this is the trap. About half of people, 20, 30 days into this, they will naturally moderate their consumption. They will start eating less than they burn. And they will do it mm-hmm. all the way down until they're at a good weight, and then they will naturally equalize.
Oh, that's interesting.
The bad part. Since that half does it, and they say, I eat all I want, and I lost weight. The other half believe it, and the other half, you know, they started 250, and they got all the way down to, like, 225 doing it. So they're convinced. So now they're, like, they're searching for a hidden carbohydrate in their creamer or some shit like that. It's like, no, look, if you're under 20 carbs, you're under 20 carbs. If you're at 25, it doesn't even matter. Right? There's you could actually stay in ketosis at about, once you're healthy, at about 50 carbohydrates. You will not always be in ketosis, but you'll be in ketosis most of the time. If you train, like you run or you lift weights, mm-hmm. and you're at 70 carbs a day, you're going to spend a few hours a day in ketosis. Right? So it's not that you fell out of ketosis because you actually ate 22.3 carbs. Mm-hmm. It's that you ate 3,000 effing calories. That's why you plateaued. And so when you tell them they can have all they want and they start doing replacement therapy and they go find cheddar crisp and they go, these taste like Cheetos.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. And then they're like, they eat a bag and there's like two carbohydrates in it. You just ate 1,500 extra calories.
Mm-hmm.
So you restrict the calories, but you only need to do a moderate restriction and your metabolism goes up. So actually, usually when a person loses weight, you have to keep cutting calories. Sometimes with ketosis, we actually have to bump them up 100 because the metabolism's revving, but then we start to actually pull it back down a little bit because, oh, wait a minute, like there's too much deficit now.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as the deficit's moderate, 15 to 20%, 20% is pretty high, even 10%, then if you're fat, your body's like, okay, we need to burn some fat to make up the difference, but everything's good. Because I'm getting high quality shit every day. Like, it's time to, like, we've come out of hibernation now. Let's jettison that. But it's all hormonally driven. But then the calories can hurt you. So, anyway, I don't want to turn into a second show or anything. We're, like, almost 2 hours now. But, you know, that's where we're at there with that. And, again, you're worth fucking 20 days. So try it.
As I said, not yet, but it's on the list.
All right.
I am rebuilding a lot of habits right now.
Yep.
And if I do too much change at once, I can't manage it. So I want to do it successfully if I do it. And my first habit was exercise consistently. So end of October was when I was looking at it.
All right.
Yeah, I'll talk to you when I get there.
Right after I shove you full of a banquet of food.
Yeah, and I'm going to come to your house and drink too much.
It's not going to be that bad. I mean, we're going to make it where, like, everybody's going to overeat, but yeah. You will only overcarb if you choose to.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it always is at your event. You don't don't want to do carbs, you don't have to.
That's a big difference for me this time, too. So I used to consider a cheat day when you ate carbs. Now I consider a cheat day when I eat more food.
Ah, interesting.
So, like, people think they're in a carbohydrate-deprived state. You're not. Your body, if you eat sufficient protein to meet your structural needs and a little bit more protein than that, your body can make all the – your body doesn't need a little glucose. It can make all it needs from protein. It's called gluconeogenesis, and that's why things like Atkins stall out too. You eat too much protein and not enough fat, right? So your liver can take protein and turn it into glucose. The thing is, unless you're starving, it will only make as much of that as is necessary because it's hard. It takes work. Your body actually has priorities that it sets. Mm-hmm. This is why, like, you have to stop drinking if you want to lose weight. I have one or two drinks one or two days a week. And it's like a glass, 5 ounce glass of wine, and I count the carbs and I count the calories. And the reason is alcohol is a toxin. We know this. And so when there's alcohol in your body, your liver says, okay, I have to eliminate this. And that means that no glucose burning, no anything can happen in your liver until the alcohol's gone. Because everything else can be dealt with some other way. And only I and only this process can deal with the alcohol. So think about a computer running a program. If you run a high enough demanding program, you can only run that program till it's done or the computer locks
up. Right.
So your liver says, I have to eliminate this alcohol. So if you have a drink, your liver can do that in about an hour. So you've taken the computer offline for an hour. But if you stretch the drink over an hour, it's like, it could still do some, auxiliary processes. And then it can go right back in. As soon as you push it past its capacity, you're going to, whatever amount of time it takes, it will take about the same amount of time of recovery to go back to fat burning. So the two things that I've done is, one, I restrict, three things, I restrict calories, unlike the time I've done in the past, and I didn't plateau. Cheat means more food, not more carbohydrates, and alcohol has to be severely restricted until I'm 190 pounds again.
Uh-huh.
And
it's that third one that's, I'm waiting till October is over. Because that's my issue. I don't actually crave carbs.
You know what I found, though, which great? It sucks at first because you're like, you missed that drink. So I just drank, like, flavored soda water, like, by the gallon for the first couple of weeks, which is fine anyway because you're purging excess fluid.
Yeah.
You're going to pee your brains out. You're dropping toxins. You need it. So I took over the habit with something else. I did not have my one drink a week during that. I went about 3 weeks without a drop of alcohol. This is what happens now. This is actually a wonderful experience. I wait till about 8 o'clock at night, maybe 8:30, to have a glass of wine. I have one glass of wine. And you know me. I'm not exactly someone that's a lightweight when it comes to alcohol.
Right.
I drink that one glass of wine. I don't really feel buzzed. I feel relaxed. An hour later, I go to sleep like somebody hit me with a box of rocks in the head.
Oh, that's awesome.
The sedative nature of alcohol works best at a low volume. Because what happens to a guy that drinks 7 beers in an hour?
They get crazy.
He turns into our friend Mike. You know which one I mean. They get loud, right?
Yeah.
They start screaming and yelling. But a person who drinks a drink goes to bed. Like, I never even knew that because, you know what? I never had one drink. When I used to make my own beer, I've used the 24-ounce or 22-ounce bottles. And people ask why. I said, well, I'm never going to have one anyway. So it's less bottles.
Yeah, fewer caps.
If you would have told me 3 months ago that you would enjoy having a drink and not a second one, I would have said, man, you don't know me.
Mm-hmm.
And I will drink more than that at times. I'm not putting away Party Jack forever. And I will drink at this workshop. We are going to have a booze circle.
Yeah.
And that's occasional. And that's what actually occasional means. But the days of drinking 4 or 5 drinks in a day, consistently all the time, not good for you anyway.
Right.
That's over for me. And it's probably going to save my life.
Yeah, probably.
It's probably going to save my life. And that's something people need to come to terms with on their own time.
Yeah, absolutely true. Okay, people who haven't figured out how to get hold of you and want to connect, how should they do that, Jack?
Go to my website, and so you don't have to type, you know, The Survival Podcast. I have this cool little short URL, tspc.co. And if you don't believe .co works, go to my website just to check and see if it works. tspc.co, stick it in your phone or your computer, hit the button, site will show up, you can check stuff out. We have done over 2,500 episodes. If you can think of it, if it's liberty, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, it's there. We've done it more than once. People say, how do I find it? Well, there's a search bar. I would just type what you're looking for in there, and you might find an article or two, but mostly it will be podcasts.
Yep.
I think I figured out there's 2,600, it's something like 12,000 posts on the blog at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of information there.
There's a lot of information there. And the search on your site works really well, guys. So, seriously, if you want to, you know, learn about wild edible plants or anything,
and
you just type
tags.
It in and see what comes up.
And then use the tags. I'm pretty good about tagging stuff. The expert council shows and the feedback, I just tag as that. So they're variety shows. But if I do something on herbs and you find an herb show you like, there'll be a bunch of tags at the bottom. And if you click herbal, you will find a treasure trove of information on herbs, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thanks, Jack, for being on the show.
Hey, I appreciate you having me. And let me know if you want to do it again or if you want to don't do more than a 10-minute segment online and come hang out for a while. We're always open to that as well.
Awesome. We'll do.